I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's Friday, September 13th, and welcome to the third and final day of ECTRIMS 2019. And before we get too far into today's podcast episode, I feel like I have a bit of housekeeping to take care of, because for the past couple of days, I keep opening the podcast by telling you that it's October, when we're barely halfway through the month of September. So I apologize for apparently losing track of time. I guess it can attribute it to being in a time zone that's 9 hours ahead of home for me, coupled with an almost complete lack of sleep. But a 9-hour time difference shouldn't equate to somehow skipping a whole month. So again, you have my apologies. And it's my pleasure to welcome you back to September, which of course was never really gone. This final day at ECTRIMS has become my favorite day of the conference, because it's the day that I get to sit down with Dr. Bruce Bibo, the Executive Vice President of Research at the National MS Society, and get his perspective on the highlights of the entire conference. In a moment, we'll talk with my special guest, Dr. Bruce Bibo. Joining me on this special episode of Real Talk MS from Day 3 of ECTRIMS is Dr. Bruce Bibo, the Executive Vice President of Research at the National MS Society. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Bibo.
It's great to be with you, John. It's another year and lots of cool stuff to talk about.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to getting into all of that. But before we get into what you're seeing and hearing this year, I'm wondering if you can take a moment and maybe explain the importance of a conference like ECTRIMS. What makes more than 10,000 scientists and clinicians decide that they need to be here?
So ECTRIMS is it's the highlight of the year. These are the probably most exciting 3 days of the year if you're interested in MS research and science in MS. As you mentioned, it's 10,000 of people from around the world. There's a lot of languages being spoken. You probably heard as you walk through the hallways. That's the reason why people come here. It's the largest meeting focused solely on MS, where the leading laboratories that are doing research in MS are communicating their latest findings in research. The companies that develop medications for MS are reporting a lot of their latest findings, both for new emerging medications and also following the long-term safety and long-term effectiveness of all the disease-modifying medications. That kind of work is presented here. I thought it was interesting to learn that the ECTRIMS meeting was in Stockholm 9 years ago, and the number of attendees at that meeting in 1998 in Stockholm was 1,700, and 9 years later, the number of people attending the ECTRIMS meeting is 10,000. And I think this sort of just reflects the growing interest and excitement and advances that we've seen in our understanding of MS and the therapies for MS. And it's just real, it's pretty cool and pretty exciting to be here.
Well, you've been here for 3 days, so let us know what presentations or announcements have stood out to you at this year's conference.
Yeah, so I mentioned a minute ago, I think there's a lot of presentations that are focused on trying to understand the long-term benefits and the long-term risks and side effects for the now 17 disease-modifying therapies we have in MS. And so there's a fair amount of presentations, both in the form of oral talks and presentations and in the form of posters where the scientists are presenting their data around, again, understanding long-term effectiveness, long-term safety, and getting the kind of information that we need to be able to get better at understanding which individual person is going to respond to which individual agent. So I was at a presentation earlier today where there was a discussion around whether high efficacy therapy at the beginning of disease was the most appropriate way to treat, and another a conflicting viewpoint of that escalating from a lower efficacy treatment to a higher efficacy treatment was a better approach. So that's still not clear. But what was really clear from that was that early treatment, whether it's with a high efficacy treatment or escalating from a lower one, if it's done within the first 5 years after being diagnosed, is that's the real critical time frame to get treated. So that's the kind of information we're learning, I'd say, from these longer term extension studies of the disease modifying treatments that we already have. There are also, this is an opportunity for laboratories and companies to share the outcomes from some of the pivotal, if you want to say, phase three studies of medications that we may see on the market in a few years. So there were a few of those studies that were reported out. One was a drug called ponosumab that reported for relapsing MS. That's a drug that's in the same family as Gilenya that might have improved probably tolerability from a point of view of nausea and flushing and things like that. Reported out very positive data this week as actually, I think I'm seeing people leave the session right now for a drug called ofatumumab. These are sort of tongue twisters a little bit, but this is a medication that's related to Ocrevus that showed really dramatic results, a 50% decrease in relapse rates compared not to placebo, because it's unethical to do placebo-controlled trials in relapsing MS, but compared to Aubagio. So a 50% decrease in relapses and a significant change in the risk for progressing, for disease progression in a group treated with ofatumumab. I don't know what they're going to call that when they finally come up with a better name than ofatumumab. But so those are, that's it, some of the exciting work that's being reported out, at the ECTRIMS meeting.
I think that's really interesting, and it's probably a detail that some people listening might tend to overlook, that the research on a drug does not stop the day it receives its FDA or EMA approval. This research continues years and even decades later.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, you mentioned decades, you know, the first disease-modifying treatment in MS, betaseron, we're still learning valuable information about following the patients from that study. And just a quick example, you know, 20-plus years later, we can look at the mortality of people who were treated with betaseron in that trial. And part of the participants in the trial received medication at the beginning, and some of them received medication a few months after the beginning of the trial. And there are differences 20 years later in mortality, in outcomes that are very, it again emphasizes, and I can't emphasize it strongly enough, that early treatment, whether it's aggressive treatment or escalating from a milder treatment to a more stronger treatment, that the key is early, it's clearly beneficial in the long run for people living with MS.
You know, the paradox there, I think, from the patient's point of view is within 5 years of your diagnosis, initially, person may feel, you know what, I have such minor symptoms, or it's really not getting in the way of anything. And so they put off starting that disease modifying therapy. But you're hearing, I'm hearing over and over again, that the sooner you start, regardless of what your personal symptom set may be, it's going to serve you well later down the road.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that not only goes for pharmacological therapies, but it goes for other approaches for modulating the course of MS. So in addition, so we talked a lot about pharmacology and drugs and things so far, but this is also at this meeting is a group called RIMS, which is research or rehabilitation in MS, and they focus on rehabilitation and exercise. And so there's a lot of sessions about the benefits for exercise, for rehabilitation. And I'd categorize the outcomes as there's clear benefits no matter what stage of MS you're in, whether you have advanced MS or whether you're at the beginning of your journey with MS. There are clear benefits for rehabilitation and for exercise in the long-term outcomes with MS. At this meeting, I was particularly impressed with a study looking at exercise in people that had very mild MS. They were at the beginning of their journey with MS. And this result or the study showed that even exercise in people who have MS that's very mild, where they don't have a lot of symptoms, exercise really at the beginning creates better outcomes, you know, decades later, when it comes to progression, when it comes to falls and those kinds of things. So it's not just about pharmacology, but it's also about non-pharmacological interventions like rehabilitation or exercise or even cognitive approaches to improve cognition in MS can have benefits at any point in time in someone's journey with MS, but particularly strong benefits if those things are started early on.
That is so interesting. You know, as you're talking about the benefits of exercise, it just kind of echoes in my mind over and over again that the things we all knew about before anyone had to deal with MS impacting their life is staying active seems to be a healthy thing to do. It's a good lifestyle choice to make. Choosing not to smoke is a good lifestyle choice to make. Choosing to be smart about picking your diet and just eating more healthy. Well, all these things benefit everyone, including people, but now it's kind of especially people living with MS, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And I think, trying to think about perhaps what the reasons are for that, where that benefit derives from. And I think at least part of the benefits derive from reducing the risk for other health conditions that can layer on top of MS. And that the medical term for that is comorbidities. And so these are other health conditions that, even people with MS might be more prone to. So we know from studying groups of people with MS that people with MS are more prone to cardiovascular disease, and they're more prone to high blood pressure and high cholesterol. And we also know that if you layer another health condition on top of MS, for example, let's say cardiovascular disease or type 2 diabetes, that accelerates disease progression. So I think part of the benefit of diet and part of the benefit of exercise is derived from decreasing or lowering a person's risk for other health conditions or comorbidities that layer on top of MS that we know can accelerate progression. So I think if you are taking a disease modifying treatment, if you live with relapsing forms of or forms of MS that are where there are disease modifying treatments that are available to you, and you're on top of layering on top of that, paying attention to your diet and paying attention to to exercise. And as you said, John, not smoking and, you know, all these things that are sometimes feel good, but aren't good for you. I think you're doing everything you can possibly do to slow down or even stop the progression of MS.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I happen to think there's an added benefit. I think it becomes very empowering when you can take control of the choices you're making, knowing that you are going to benefit. You are part of, you're taking an active role in the fight against MS instead of being a passive victim.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that's empowering, and that may in of itself have also a benefit for people with MS. And so there are things anybody can do, and we emphasize early treatment, both from a pharmaceutical point of view and from a wellness point of view. But no matter where you are in your journey with MS, there's something you can do to help increase your risk for or decrease your risk for progression, slowing progression down at any stage you are in your MS.
Well, we've been talking a lot about early treatment and things you can do early on in once you've been diagnosed. But there have been some presentations at the conference that kind of take that a step further and talk about things that are happening to people or may have happened to people who are living with MS well before their time of diagnosis. Red flags that perhaps are difficult to see at first.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought it up. So I've been thinking a lot about over the last couple of years about how we might develop strategies for perhaps even preventing MS from happening in the first place. And I think that that idea requires that we have the capacity to predict or stratify the population based on their risk for developing MS. And I think we're accumulating evidence and be able to start stratifying people into different risk categories. And perhaps we're going to get to a point where we are able to stratify people based on risk with enough confidence that it would be ethical to use that information to start treating MS before it clinically becomes apparent. And that scientific term is called prodromal, that period of time when a disease may be starting, but there aren't any clinical manifestations of it. So this could come from a variety of sources. So there was an interesting study that was presented this week looking at a banked blood or serum derived from blood from members of the military. So you enlist in the military and you get your hair cut and then you get your blood drawn and the blood gets stored and then you can follow these large groups of military members over a long period of time and identify when, for example, they get diagnosed with MS. So you can take the military members that were diagnosed with MS and you can compare them to a group of military members that didn't develop MS and look at their blood and see if there's something different. So this study identified that this marker or biomarker called neurofilament light chain levels were higher in the serum from the blood derived from military members that went on to develop MS 6 years later compared to the military members that didn't develop MS. Now, neurofilament light chain is a protein. It's a structural protein for nerve cells. And normally, you don't really have very high levels of it. But when your nervous system gets damaged, the cells get disrupted, that structural protein gets released, and you can measure it in the blood. And it's a general, probably more of a biomarker for nervous system damage. But it does indicate that there might potentially, with more studies, be a biomarker that could be part of a puzzle of predicting or stratifying people into low and high risk categories. There's another study that a very different study that looked at healthcare utilization. So same concept, you have kind of groups of people in a healthcare system that went on to develop MS and other groups that didn't develop MS. And you look at information about them in that prodromal period to see, can I figure out who's going to develop MS and who's not? And this, what the study showed was that if you looked at the healthcare utilization pattern in the cohort or group of people that ultimately went on to develop MS, you could find that they utilized the healthcare system in a discrete way from people that went on to develop other inflammatory conditions, for example, like Crohn's disease. So that included reports of our use of the healthcare system for problems with vision. So that kind of makes sense. Problems, some nervous system problems and musculoskeletal problems. So there was a pattern that you could see in healthcare utilization in that group of patients that ultimately went on to develop MS. And so I think what the future looks like is, you know, a combination of developing a risk score a little bit. Maybe some people are familiar with sort of the Framingham risk score for cardiovascular disease, and it uses family history of cardiovascular disease and lipid profiles and other variables that create a 10-year risk score. And then your treatment is for cardiovascular disease or prevention is based on where you fit in that risk. And I that's the vision I have right now for MS. Where we could use some blood markers for perhaps neurofilament light chain. We could use a genetic information. We can use family history information. Perhaps we can use healthcare utilization information. Perhaps we can use, there's a lot of pretty cool stuff this week looking at how we can use our smartphones and wearable devices to identify subtle changes in how people might walk or talk or act. All of that sort of building up a picture and creating a risk score like a Framingham risk score for MS so that we could identify people that are in this prodromal phase before they develop symptoms and have enough confidence in this risk score that it informs therapy. And that we talked about already that early treatment, people have better outcomes. Well, what if we could treat MS before it ever became clinically apparent? I think we would have even better outcomes. And I think we could, in some people, probably prevent MS from happening in the first place. I think we might have even maybe have done that already. I think we might have treated people with very, very, very early signs of MS with some disease-modifying therapies that are basically disease-free. I would say, John, right now, there are probably people we've cured. And I think it's about learning how we did that and expanding it to broader and populations of people. And I do think this sort of risk factor approach and treating in this prodromal phase is one direction, I think, very, very promising direction that could help us prevent MS from occurring in hopefully large groups of people.
You know, a lot of people who listen to the podcast regularly know that I'm kind of a tech geek at heart. And as you were talking about these analyses of military members and healthcare utilization, these are very large, large data sets, obviously. And I guess the engine that's allowing for so much of this discovery has to do with the fact that now we have the technology that can crunch these numbers, what people refer to as big data. We have the ability to slice and dice it in such a way as to be able to see things that previously, even our, you know, most advanced computers, it was just too much for them to try to manage.
Yeah, that's right. And that's an interesting point. I've seen a lot of presentations and posters this week using a technique called machine learning. And so apparently, I'm not, this is a little outside my area of expertise, but, you know, these are algorithms where, and it sounds a little bit like Terminator, right? Like where the machines take over. There's a little bit of, you know, caution we have to exercise, I think there, but we can teach computers how to learn, and then they can look for patterns in data that can help, for example, with imaging data, perhaps predict or prognosticate disease based on imaging patterns in MRI images that the human eye or human brain can't recognize, but that a computer using these deep learning, machine learning algorithms can pick out. And I understand that this sort of renaissance now, an explosion in this machine learning being applied, is that the algorithms and formulas have been around for a while, but we didn't have the computer power to apply them to these big data sets until the last few years. And it is really revolutionizing our approach to research in NMS and a lot of other places. But I'm glad you brought it up, because there were a lot of posters and presentations, particularly in the imaging area, but also in other sort of big health databases, using machine learning and technology to try to find patterns in data that can help help us, again, predict response to therapy, predict a person's disease course, perhaps predict which medications, you know, a person might respond to, and get us closer to the one goal that we have in MS and a lot of other diseases of personalized medicine.
Everything you just said is being applied to MS and as you mentioned, to all sorts of research endeavors because the technology permits this. I know that Google, which has perhaps one of the most complex machine learning set of algorithm libraries in the world, one of their engineers literally in his spare time programmed their machine learning masterpiece of a computer, their AI brain, to look at, I believe, 15,000 images taken by NASA satellites. And after it looked at all those, it looked at photographs taken with the Hubble telescope, and the computer discovered two new planets that NASA had missed. But the computer said, look, all of the patterns are here. So pay attention to this, because given what I know, there ought to be two planets here. And there were. Yeah. Well, you apply the same thing to someone looking at an MRI, where a computer can say, based on what I know, this is something that demands more attention. And it could be something that the human eye simply can't capture.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. You're real good, John, at explaining it in ways that people can understand. That's exactly right. I think We just have to make sure that we turn off Skynet before it becomes active.
Yes. Hopefully the machines won't be coming for us one day. Well, you know, once again, this is the best part of my ECTRIMS trip has turned into this annual get together. So, as always, I appreciate it so much. Dr. Bruce Bebo, I'll see you same time next year.
I look forward to it. Thanks, John.
That's going to wrap up this special ECTRIMS episode of Real Talk MS. I'm heading back to Los Angeles tomorrow morning, but I hope that you and I can keep talking. While ECTRIMS may be over for another year, there are clinical trial outcomes to look forward to, new treatments and technologies to explore, new discoveries to learn about. In other words, we have a lot to talk about. So if you've just discovered the podcast, I hope you join me every week for a new episode of Real Talk MS. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.